Well, good morning. My name is Michael McCusker, and I'd like to start with a quote from Jack Denon, whom some of you might recognize. When the rich attack the poor, that is war. When the poor attack the rich, that is terrorism. And from myself, an article I wrote back at the turn of the century and millennium in January, February 2001, barrels of blood were offered in exchange for barrels of oil. The world has a glut of human blood, but oil is finite and will likely dry up sometime in this new century. The oil wars. Every war can be traced back centuries, a vengeful antipathy beneath a contemporary surface of conflict, most often religious at its root. The more devastating and never forgiven wars are religiously based, holy wars, crusades, jihads, whatever they may be called. And it seems that every century has an explosive recurrence among the same theolytical combatants. And now the world is a decade into a new millennium of a religiously inspired calendar that bifurcates history. The cusps of millenniums seem to stir apocalyptic prophecies to greater carnage to obliterate opposing theologies. The last millennial milestone in 1000 AD sparked holy wars that lasted three centuries and have never really ceased. This third Christian millennium started ominously, a surprise assault on the foremost temples of Christian capitalism by radical Islamists. Although the United States has treated 9/11 as an unprovoked attack upon an innocent nation, it was retribution for earlier provocations and has itself been ruthlessly revenged, so far in Afghanistan and in Iraq, which probably had very little to do with it. Saddam Hussein was a tyrant, but he was a non-Muslim, a viper in the Muslim temple. And more recently, Iran and Syria are in jeopardy of being engulfed in the new Western Crusade. The attacks on September 11, 2001, transcended the secularly political and moved into the demagogic metaphysical, an archaic and mythological abstraction of peoples certain they are the instruments of God, whether Judeo-Christian or Islamic, bloody-minded retribution against innocence to revenge atrocities committed against innocence. A major rhetorical elevation of vengeance against the terrorists into the theolytical was President George W. Bush's appellation of them as evil and their accused leader, Osama bin Laden, as the evil one. Osama bin Laden, for his part, seemed to desire a return to 7th century Mecca, to early Islam, which nurtured one of the world's most literate and scholastic civilizations. A return to basics, so to speak, in a manner similar to ecumenical Christians who wish revival of a medieval piety that never existed except in imagination and myth. The devastating and unprecedented attack against the United States on 9/11 was not directed at the World Trade Center and Pentagon, and perhaps the White House, as mere symbols of American power, but instead as the true center of the USA's political, economic, and militarily global supremacy. That was clearly the perspective of those who elaborately planned and executed the attacks. They regarded those employed in those two centers, and surely the White House, as directly responsible for American actions around the world, as are U.S. soldiers, diplomats, and multinational corporations based in the USA. Total war is not only the prerogative of military regimes, but also of those who struggle against them by any means at hand, however horrible and catastrophic the results. In an unconditional war, everybody is a soldier, which was the rationale of the mass bombings of cities in World War II, and certainly the use of two atomic bombs on Japan, which ushered in the nuclear age and its iconic mushroom cloud that billows over everything else. Those who committed the atrocity of 9/11 did not do it because they were evil, but because they perceived evil had been done to them, and they reciprocated as they were capable. A major reaction of the United States to 9/11 has been that it is irrelevant what we have done to others. All that matters is what has been done to us, which is dealt with as if it occurred in a vacuum. A grievous crime was committed against the United States on 9/11, but not one that was undeserved or should have been so unexpected. Americans have lived a long time in a false bubble that assumed that what the U.S. did elsewhere would not, in similar measure, reach back to it. Rather than seek international justice for a criminal act, the American response has been to make war and murder many more innocents without trial, and certainly without justice, as died on 9/11. The government claims these deaths were by accident and not intent, which apologists insist is much different than the planned murders of 9/11. But war is murder on a mass scale, and Americans allowed themselves to be herded into war with little resistance. 9/11 unleashed a frenzy of bellicose patriotism in the United States. Prejudice, always waiting with its intolerant leer, leaped into the dialogue much earlier. Whatever people in the Middle East called the massive influx of Westerners into their deserts during the Gulf War 20 years ago, Gulf War I, some words that quickly became prevalent in the United States to describe the diverse types of humanity in the Arab lands were ragheads and desert niggers, which continue in usage. Post 9/11 pundits assured readers and listeners that rabid religious beliefs and hot-headed passions were typical Mideast traits. Propaganda machines erased the ambiguities of everyday life to present immediate contrasts devoid of shades. Extremes overpowered dialogue. Us against them. Good versus evil. Black and white, the only acceptable tones of public conversation. 9/11 is regarded as a pivotal point that has unsettled world societies and will echo through international relations for decades. The USA's real unity was the shock and revulsion at 9/11, but a growing political and cultural schism within the country intensified afterward as to the real motives of the attack and the nature of reaction to it. 7 years ago, on March 19, 2003, the United States invaded Iraq. President George W. Bush, the previous June, had declared to graduating West Pointers what had become known as the Bush Doctrine, a concept of preemptive war, which meant, without frills, the divine right of the U.S. to invade any nation in the world for any reason. The old-fashioned way of warfare, such as practiced by Saddam Hussein in Iran and Kuwait, the Caesars throughout the Mediterranean world, Hitler to most of Europe. The first Gulf War of 1990-1991 was to protect the world's oil supply, which Saddam Hussein put a chokehold on by invading Kuwait, similar to ancient immigrants or bandits who occasionally seized portions of the old Silk Road between Rome and China and had to be chased away by the armies of each or both. The purpose of the Second Iraq War was to depose Hussein and take control of Iraq's vast oil reserves, second largest in the world, and to frame U.S. occupation around creating a democratic, and that's in quotes, state in the Middle East. Ironically, both Iraq wars were launched by father and son presidents, George Bush Sr. and Jr., against the same Iraqi dictator who was deposed and executed during the second attempt. Perhaps the most enduring image of Gulf War I might be the nightmarish eeriness of soldiers and civilians, as well as journalists filming them, moving about in gas masks and spacesuit-like protective clothing. Virtually the entire population of Israel was issued gas masks and instructed how to seal off rooms of their homes and offices against chemical attack, though it was longer before the Israeli government reluctantly included Palestinians living in Israel and the occupied territories. The real terror, however, was the possibility of crossing the nuclear threshold, which was optioned as a response if Iraq used chemical or biological weapons, endorsed by then Pentagon Chief Dick Cheney. And particular attention was paid to possible Iraq nuclear installations during the three-week air war. The claimed success of cruise and Patriot missiles in offense and defense, so-called smart weapons, pumped up U.S. ambitions to revive pork barrel and anti-ballistic nuclear defenses against nuclear attack, the so-called Star Wars. The U.S. not only threatened to develop new nuclear weapons, but threatened they might be used against Middle Eastern nations that do not comply with U.S. mandates. Yet the U.S. demands that no other nation develop nuclear weapons, especially Iraq and North Korea. Criticism is that unless the United States practices abstinence with its own nukes, it is in no position to condemn others for wishing to develop nukes to protect themselves from U.S. nuclear threats. Developing new nuclear weapons ostensibly for the war on terrorism, while threatening other countries to not develop WMDs, is a contradiction that brings the world closer to the long-anticipated millennial obliteration. In the meantime, two decades later, American Gulf War veterans continue to suffer from generally undiagnosed diseases. Contrary to years of Pentagon denials of chemical exposure in the Gulf, unclassified documents and surveys of veterans confirm that Gulf veterans are not as healthy as other service members who were not deployed to the war. Particularly suspect is the use of depleted uranium from nuclear weapons for conventional artillery shells and bombs, which are still used in Iraq and Afghanistan by a newer generation of American soldiers. Uranium-depleted weapons are the most unreported story about the wars in Iraq, with the exception of Iraqi casualties. Soldiers spend a year or more exposed to these cancer-causing weapons, and in the future, their health problems will undoubtedly have a considerable effect on U.S. society, although the Agent Orange example of Vietnam veterans does not indicate adequate treatment or compensation. The second Iraq War was started ostensibly to deter Saddam Hussein's use of weapons of mass destruction, but they were never found, and search for them essentially stopped. Since the purported WMDs did not materialize, the purpose of the war was subsequently proclaimed the democratization of Iraq, with so-called coalition troops occupying the country against an unanticipated insurgency until it is sufficiently stabilized to allow Iraq's immense reserves of oil to flow unvexed into American and Western European barrels. The war was not forced upon the United States by a declared enemy, but by its own president and an acquiescent Congress, as well as by a coterie of neocons who had urged invasion of Iraq since the U.S. failed to depose Saddam Hussein at the end of Gulf War I. Also in the sparse coalition of willing allies were American business interests who hoped to reap gazillions of dollars in post-war Iraq, especially from oil, military supply, and reconstruction contracts. The Bush Jr. administration was determined to make war against Iraq from the start and only went through the motions of United Nations approval, essentially because of worldwide dissent and protest. The president failed at diplomacy, which had been his intent. He barely went through the motions, showing his contempt for the UN throughout. He shammed validation for his feckless and unnecessary, and that's a quote, desire for war. The people who wanted war with Iraq were ideological conservatives in the White House, whose theolytically inspired historical vision was that perpetual warfare, a Christian jihad, is the means to protect and expand the American neo-empire, which they called the New World Order, a term also used by Adolf Hitler for his Nazi nightmare of world dominance, the also called Thousand-Year Reich back in the 20th century. Even at the time, it was not too difficult to cut through the smoke and mirrors and realize the people of the USA were hoodwinked about the Second Iraq War. From absolute certainty that weapons of mass destruction, and that's a quote, were about to be launched against our sacred soil, to the Bushites' abnegation that they had not intentionally, also in quotes, misled the nation about the presence of WMDs. The Bush Jr. administration stalled a 9/11 investigation by Congress until after the Iraq invasion. The report showed Saddam Hussein was not involved in 9/11 or with al-Qaeda. If the report had been released in January 2003 as scheduled, it would have revealed there was no reason to attack Iraq. This was coupled with the Bush administration's fabrication that Iraq was about to purchase weapons-grade uranium from Niger. President Bush asserted America's cause of preemptive invasion as moral and just, but there really is no such thing as a just war, only defense or revenge against unjust acts of violence or aggression. A certain cause might be considered just, but no such claim can be made for the carnage that results. A distinction between just wars and unjust wars, made in medieval times by the Christian Church to justify its religious wars, is equally or more important in regard to a war's conduct as to its reason. The main distinction is the prohibition of intentionally targeting civilians in a war to be considered a just war, nor should disproportionate force be used. But as the wholesale bombing by both sides in World War II indicates, the differences are too often degrees of propaganda than reality. Reasons for not going to war with Iraq were clearly stated by the opposition prior to the invasion. Some of the more salient points were that war with Iraq would not make America safer, but would instead increase anti-American sentiment and perpetuate a cycle of terrorism. It would destabilize the Middle East, including Israel-Palestine and neighboring Arab nations, undermine international cooperation, take the lives of U.S. soldiers and innocent Iraqi citizens. Accounts range from 30,000 to 600,000 Iraqis, and would cost from $100 to $200 billion a month, as well as defy international law, including the United Nations Charter. The most persistent opposition to war with Iraq was from realization that multitudes of innocent citizens would be killed, injured, and maimed. Millions throughout the world and the United States demonstrated against the war before and after invasion of Iraq. Peace activities became more intense as the velocity toward war accelerated, and every act to prevent or forestall war was criticized, downplayed, and ultimately ignored by the Bush White House with arrogant disregard for any other possibility than war. Dissent against the war was countered with the virtual decree that everyone should unconditionally support American troops in Iraq, whether or not they supported the war, which is similar to deploring a crime but praising the criminal. In this case, taking offense against the killing ought not to interfere with encouraging the killers. The logic that a populace must support its troops once a war has begun is an incentive to always start a war, which Germany was twice punished for doing as well as for supporting its troops. Political leaders insist we must support a war while it is being conducted and discuss opposition to it at the appropriate time, which they mean after a war is over. This is absurd. It is during a war that it must be examined and questioned, something we have held Germans responsible for not having done. The real shock and awe of the Iraq War was the incessant assault on American civil liberties by the Bush administration, which turned the United States into a homeland security state that relied on martial law rather than democracy. The national dialogue was reduced to pious simplicities in which patriotic Americans could do no wrong, and the rest of the world was either with us or against us, which included unpatriotic Americans who disagreed. War protesters were equated with terrorists and implied to be traitors. Every community in the USA continues to be divided over the Iraq War, 7 years later, as well as the renewed surge of warfare in Afghanistan. And the despotic policies of the Bush administration persist, inspiring domestic politics. Portraying opponents of the war, or the Bush presidency, as heretics and apostates, and threatening to constrain them with the repressive laws, was not quite the freedom and human rights the war on terrorism was claimed to be. Bush brashly disregarded any evil, and that's a quote, among his avaricious friends and patrons, and their blatant warmongering and profiteering, and sermonized about freedom and democracy, while these same cohorts made an intolerable grab for power in the form of corporate autocracy that has severely eroded much of the basic fiber of democracy. The unilateral U.S. surge to absolute military superiority has isolated it more than ever and contributes to the debilitating schism that afflicts American society. Its projection of unprecedented power might prove to be what most Americans do not want. The public does not desire to be the world's foremost aggressor nation, nor does it wish to assume the risks. The power of the American democracy lies in the hands of the citizenry, which eventually will have to say enough to a U.S. imperialism of the sort envisioned by those who crave U.S. military and economic dominance over the world. It is unfortunate the Obama administration seems to conform to the discredited policies of the previous administration, despite the financial and military disasters inflicted by it. The Bushites took a great risk threatening the possibility of continuing, and certainly escalating, war in the Middle East. It is possible they recognized this as the last chance for a unilateral grab at world resources, a situation the U.S. itself precipitated with its war in Iraq. And although the U.N. is in crisis as a result of U.S. actions, it is not quite shattered and might very well strongly rebound with a sort of world versus USA face-off that will most likely force the United States to stand down with what it has already grabbed. Muslims throughout the world view the war in Iraq as an act of imperialist aggression and are responding. The United States is not exporting democracy to the Middle East. If democracy takes hold, it will be because the people in those countries desire aspects of it adaptive to their cultures. The real purpose of America's position in the Middle East is to wrest control of the world's major oil supply before its capacity peaks and declines. If democracy does take root in Islamia, it will be a petroleum byproduct. The war in Iraq, the cradle of civilization, is an ironic symbol that humanity is threatening its future by never getting past the conflicts of its earliest superstitions, which originated from the most elemental questions pertaining to life and purpose, but have been frozen in mutually savage dogmas like fossils in ice. And that's something I wrote, The Oil Wars. And continuing along more or less the same subject, I like to read an article by Stephen Burke in the February Hipfish, Same as the Old Boss. It may come as a disappointment to the throngs of enthusiastic Americans who voted for change they could believe in, but President Obama's foreign policy is not much different from his predecessors. While he is minus the swagger of Bush's unilateralism and his preemptive war doctrine, his means and ends remain much the same. In fact, regardless of which party is in power, American foreign policy has demonstrated remarkable coherence since the beginning of the Cold War and the national security state in the late 40s. This means global expansion of the American military presence to keep open channels for our global investment. During the Cold War, common wisdom held that large defense budgets and the arms race were necessary to counter a Soviet system opposed to free markets. But since the USSR and most of communism collapsed in 1989, are continuing to expand military bases throughout the world, they now total somewhere between 700 and 800, and retaining defense budgets equivalent to more than the rest of the world put together would seem excessive. During the Clinton years, the president and his foreign policy team were ever looking for new outlets of military adventurism. cruel sanctions and relentless bombing of the civilian infrastructure of Saddam Hussein's Iraq, to the point of massive suffering of its people and the expansion of NATO as instruments of, quote, humanitarian, unquote, warfare against, again a quote, rogue states, and for penetration of the Caspian oil region, formerly a Soviet entity, were important means of American power projection. But Clinton's liberal hawks lacked a worldwide cause comparable to their predecessors' crusade against communism. After September 11, 2001, however, the Bush administration could recommit the nation to full-scale expansionism, now in a global war on terror. Never mind that the enemy this time lacked an army, navy, air force, or any sophisticated weaponry. The fact that our domestic security lapses had permitted a ragtag band of chiefly Saudi jihadists to use three of our own commercial planes as missiles in two of our cities was the entire basis we needed. The point is that the nature of the worldwide enemy makes no difference, so long as one can be provided as a rationale for American power projection. Retired Army Colonel Boston University history professor Andrew Basevich argues that the U.S. seeks in the global war on terror to retain a profligate consumerism by gaining vital control of a declining world oil supply. In this regard, he seconds fellow historian Michael Clare's prediction in the 1990s that the new millennium would see the U.S. embroiled in continuous resource wars, and that's a quote. Most Americans supported George Bush Sr.'s declaration that the American standard of living is non-negotiable, as he became the first president to place hundreds of thousands of troops in Middle Eastern sands during the initial Iraq War. It was this war of some 20 years ago that caused a Saudi, Osama bin Laden, to form al-Qaeda as means of resisting the infidel's military presence in his country, the Islamic Holy Land. In The Limits of Power, Basevich argues that Americans continue to pile up trillions of dollars in debt by wasting it in wars to sustain an unsustainable lifestyle. One might question his application of profligacy to Americans at large, since the average American has been on a steep wage slide since the era of corporate globalization and the outsourcing of our industries began in the 1980s. It is not that Americans as a whole are so profligate. They have been induced to go deeply into debt to pay for things, education, housing, that their parents in post-war America, World War II, could afford on one breadwinner's salary. Basevich is right about a profligate American lifestyle, but it applies chiefly to elites who dominate our economic and political institutions and lay claim to over 90% of our national wealth. This is the true constituency of a corporate-funded Congress, a president who continues costly militarism, and a Supreme Court that grants transnational capital total control of our politics in Citizens United versus United States Electoral Commission, 2010. And that was...